Welcome to Section D, Monocle's weekly design show with me, Hugo MacDonald. Following Tokyo Design Week, we're putting the spotlight on Japanese design this week. Coming up, our Tokyo correspondent Danielle Dimitriou finds out how the Japanese design community is coping after the devastating events of March earlier in the year.
We could found that the designer exhibiting here this year are very strong and they are very focused and they have very strong concept. That's why they are doing this and that's why they are, you know, facing to the future.
I then headed to Sam Hecht's studio to hear about his love for Japanese design.
You know, it was quite sad to a point where, you know, I was like, you know, I was buying suits from Muji, underwear, food.
And we spin the globe from Sydney to London to LA on a shopping spree for all things Japanese.
We've been selling a lot of the Mari balls, which is a hand-coiled, vegetable-dyed balls.
Plus, we talk Japanese fireworks, food design, handcrafted furniture, and pug magazines. All that and much, much more ahead in this episode of Section D. But first, it's time for this week's design news with Gillian DeBias.
Spanish architecture practice Cloud9 walked away with the much-coveted Building of the Year prize at the World Architecture Awards in Barcelona for their media ICT building. The Barcelona architecture community were ecstatic, given that both Cloud9 and the winning building are based in the host city. Sticking with awards and staying in Barcelona, the prize for Interior of the Year at the inaugural World Festival of Interiors went to Shanghai practice Neri and Hu. Their winning design is an intriguing, austere hotel in the abandoned former headquarters of the Japanese Army in Shanghai. The London 2012 Olympic Committee has just released the official posters, 12 of them, designed by the creme de la creme of Britain's art crowd, including Tracy Emin, Martin Creed, and Sarah Morris. They're a mixed bag. Critical response has been similarly mixed, pointing to the lack of representation by the UK's world-leading graphic designers, who should have been given a go. A mirrored cube treehouse by Swedish practice Tom and Vidigord, originally designed for the Tree Hotel in northern Sweden, is available to buy as a flat pack design. The mirror cube, as it's called, is 4x4x4 meters of mirrored glass designed for two. It will cost €275,000, a snip, given the hours of pleasure you can have looking at and out of it if you have a forest on your doorstep.
Hello and welcome to Section D. Or should I say, Section D e yokoso. Yes, this week it's a veritable Japan fest as we take a close look at what makes Japanese design so peculiarly perfect. It's not just a whim, either. Last week was Tokyo's annual design week, and our correspondents were out in force. Danielle Dimitriou headed to the heart of the event at Design Tide to find out how the design industry in Japan has coped following the horrific events of March the 11th.
This week, Tokyo is awash with design events. From exhibitions and trade fairs to events and talks. These events may happen every year, but this year they undoubtedly carry a greater significance, bearing in mind that it's the first major design event for the capital since the March the 11th earthquake, tsunami and nuclear crisis. If there is one man who knows about design in Tokyo, it's Masaki Yokokawa. Also known as Mac, he is one busy man. Not only is he behind the definitive Aoyama design store Sibone, as well as George's Furniture, and the Japanese franchise of Dean & DeLuca cafes and delis, he's also a founding director of Design Tide, which is now in its 7th year. I spoke to Mac about this year's Design Tide event, discussing how Japan's design industry is reshifting its focus post-March the 11th, and also exploring what this means for the future of Japanese design in general.
Design Tide trying to be a platform for the designer and creator, which we like to make no borderless, in between. We don't want to stay just in architect or just in product. We try to make it wider and borderless and try to be very clean and focused platform for the very strong and high quality designers. Of course from Japan, but also from all over the world. We're not the select shop, or we're not, you know, selecting one style. So we always just look at the quality, how strong they think about, how deep they got processed for this idea or this design, And we also try to be very new. So we don't ask the existing producer or existing manufacturer to produce. Or usually a lot of the designers exhibiting in DesignTide are not released on the market yet. Or they're just kept in the prototype. They have not found any manufacturer to work with. But we look at the quality of idea or quality of the concept and also the originality. We had quite a lot of discussion before we think about how we're going to do this year. But also, as you can see, this year we had a lot of difference from the last year, which is like not many international designers are exhibiting, and not many companies are supporting these kind of events because of their situation is tough too. This year, we didn't ask too much for international designer to exhibit. So I think exhibitors are a little bit less than last year. But we could found that the designer exhibiting here this year are very strong, and they are very focused. And they have very strong concept. That's why they are doing this, and that's why they are, you know, facing to the future.
The impact of Japan's March the 11th disaster clearly touched all, the design world included. And this soon becomes apparent while wandering around DesignTide. Perhaps as is typical in times of crisis, the incident appeared to have sharpened the focus of many Japanese designers and led to a greater drive towards creating what is important over what is perhaps superfluous. And so one designer created edible drinking cups from rice, which can also be consumed in times of food shortages. One other project which stood out involved seeds from farmers based in radiation-hit Fukushima. I spoke to Kentaro Tamai, one of a collective of five designers behind the project.
At DesignTide Market, we're selling seeds which have originally come from Fukushima, which farmers cannot plant anymore after the March 11th earthquake. The money goes back to the farmers. I'm usually a fashion designer, so I don't normally engage in product design, but because of the earthquake, people started to rethink their lives through design. Design is now a means to communicate. It's becoming more future-orientated. I think this is a positive moment.
Non-Japanese designers may have been few and far between this year compared to previous events. However, those that did attend made sure they made a splash. I spoke to Heike Suhrmann, who works for DMY, a German design festival which is exhibiting work by 12 Berlin designers this week.
For us, it was not a difficult decision to make because we really wanted to go, especially in this year, we wanted to go. It's important to support a difficult situation, or like this is in Japan right now. This is one point why we are here. The other is that we really like to be at the DesignTide, that we have a lot of friends here, a lot of designers, a network we work with, and we didn't want to interrupt this.
All in all, it's clear that the atmosphere at this year's DesignTide was more subdued and minimalist in comparison to previous years. But despite the absence of international designers and larger scale companies, there was also an overriding sense of hope. A sense of hope, along with a quiet confidence that the power of Japanese design would be able to play a direct role in helping the nation to recover from its most challenging year in recent history. This is Danielle Dimitriou in Tokyo for Monocle 24.
You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24. Up next, it's time to talk type. I'm joined in the studio now by Monocle's creative director, Richard Spencer-Powell. Thank you for joining me again, Rich.
Welcome. Nice to be back.
I wanted to quiz you this week, given the theme of the show is on Japan and Japanese design, on your experiences with Japanese magazines and Japanese graphic design, and maybe a bit of typecutting in there as well. You were telling me a couple of days ago that you went to Kyoto.
Yeah, I've been quite fortunate. I've been to Japan quite a few times, actually. It was great. It was amazing. It was actually the early days of when we used to go to Japan. There wasn't so much business to do, so we did have a bit of downtime, so we got to explore and really, really get to know Tokyo and see, you know, all the sights. It was just fantastic. And it's one of those places I think absolutely everyone must go to if you're a graphic designer, in the way that perhaps Milan and Paris are for fashion. I think what Japan offers up in terms of graphic design and architecture, you just cannot miss it. You have to go.
And how has it influenced your work in any way, or the way that you look at pages and the way that you design and things?
I think it's just attention to detail is second to none. I mean, if they gave out sort of Michelin stars for packaging, I mean, I think everyone in Japan would have to be a 3 Michelin star.
Yeah, quite right.
Packaging department, because there simply wouldn't be a 2 Michelin or a 1 Michelin, because they just do it with detail in absolutely everything. That's just the way they do it. And so that was, I got some real tips there. And it's kind of, you know, it's hard to kind of match the standard because of the amount of effort they put in. But
the minute attention to detail is really the key thing, isn't it? And reducing everything to its barest essential.
Yeah, they do that. They're very good at doing minimal design and actually stripping things back, which is different perhaps to minimal. It's really working out what needs to be in the process and what doesn't. And that's something certainly I think I've learned from Japan and been influenced by.
And how does that process work? Is it about, I mean, we look at magazines, particularly in Europe, and there's just a lot of unnecessary things thrown on a page, decoration, but it's still quite distracting.
I agree. I think when it comes to editorial design, I'm not a fan of flash graphic design. I don't like things with bells and whistles because I think it tries to oversell what doesn't need to oversell. I think it's trying to overcompensate for the fact that there's nothing there of any interest. And so things get overlayered and, like you say, too much furniture on the page. And I just think it's unnecessary. And I think we always ask ourselves, does it need to be there? Does it serve a function? And if it doesn't, let's get rid of it.
And that is, I mean, we were talking a little bit earlier about Minge.
Yes. Minge is slightly, I'm not sure if my understanding of it is absolutely correct. It seems to have a few meanings. But I think the actual translation means craft for the people. And it was something that I learned on the bullet train down to Kyoto. My friend Naoto taught me about it. But the thing that I understood about this concept, Minge, was that in the West we tend to make the most beautiful object, the most expensive object. So it could be a very intricate watch with diamonds and gold and all sorts of things that very few people in the world could ever actually own or see even. But with Minge, it's about making the thing that everyone can use, so a spoon or a bowl, the most beautiful and the most simple. And I really sort of fell in love with that concept. I thought it was just very, just lovely and typically Japanese.
And very democratic as well.
Yeah, and there's a sort of modern simplicity to it. It's one of a warm concept for design, I'd say.
And does that spill into graphic design as well in some way?
Possibly in sort of paper choices and making things, again, it's about sort of reduction and making things very simple and, not so directly, but I think, that notion of that is still there, I believe.
Now, we passed Tyler on the stairs on the way down to the studio, who says that he's just got a massive influx of Japanese magazines. And
it probably
comes as a little surprise to everybody that Tyler's a huge fan of Japanese magazines. And every time he comes back from a trip, he thumps a huge pile of 10 different Japanese titles on a few of our desks.
He does, yeah.
And so, no, this was quite an eye-opener to me when I'd started at Monocle. Japanese magazines are very, very different. They're very, I mean,
yeah, there's a density that you don't see in Western European mags, I don't think. I mean, they're amazing. I mean, sometimes I can't work out exactly how they've managed to pull these things off, because
sleeping under desks.
I think that can be the only way, because the amount they pack in is extraordinary. And again, they leave no stone unturned when it comes to doing a story. And they've got this lovely strange ability to use English words in a way that we would never use them, but there's a kind of innocent sweetness, and it sort of makes sense. You see that in some of the sort of name choices of brands, things like Tomorrowland, you know. It's just two words juxtaposed that they actually end up meaning something quite nice, and you get that a lot in Japanese magazines.
I know, and I love the, like you were saying, the sheer density that they can devote an entire 280-page magazine to coffee.
Yeah.
And then the next issue, it might be just one person's house.
And there's whole magazines that are devote 12 issues to
You know. Pugs.
Yeah, exactly. And then, you know, there's magazines about magazines. There's magazines about people that collect magazines. And there's probably magazines about people that collect magazines about magazines. It's sort of that endless...
It goes on and on.
Yeah, it's like a culture eating itself. But it's all done with this sort of quite sweetness to it.
It's like a childlike enthusiasm and interest in things.
Sometimes I think you look at the Japanese magazine about, I don't know, carp fishing in a certain region... And you just think, this no way we would do this magazine in England because no publisher would have the belief that you could sell a single copy. But there seem to be so many of these titles in Japan about a certain type of camping, you know, people that go camping and to rock festivals. It's like a sort of subcategory. And yet there'll be seven magazines on that subject. And I think we would never be brave enough to actually put that out on the newsstand and say, people want to buy this. But clearly people want to buy it and they keep producing them. It's fantastic.
Thank you very much for joining me, Rich.
Welcome.
Keep abreast of everything from breaking news to fresh business opportunities with Monocle 24's lineup of live weekday current affairs programmes. The Globalist kicks off our day at 6 a.m. UK time with 2 hours of news, media reviews, weather and reports from our correspondents around the world. At midday UK time, The Briefing helps the North American East Coast get into gear with a brisk review of news and analysis. And at 18:30 UK, Midori House gets a first read on stories hitting Asia's front pages and does a roundup with Monocle's editors. Finally, the Monocle Daily signs on for 2 hours at 2200 with a mix of our editors and special guest anchors to start the day in Asia. Keep an eye and an ear on the world, right here on Monocle 24.
Greater pleasures in life than a great meal. The Menu is just that. A weekly one-hour programme about eating and drinking. From growers to restaurateurs, we introduce you to the people you need to know, whether you're out dining in Osaka or out carousing in Sao Paulo. That's The Menu, brought to you in association with Krug, every Tuesday on Monocle 24 at 1900 London time, here on Monocle 24, and also available on our Timeshift player at monocle.com and on iTunes.
Welcome back to Section D here on Monocle 24. Family firm Maruni has been making wooden furniture since 1928. Like any heritage family firm, it's had its ups and downs, but thanks to its current forward-thinking president, Takeshi Yamanaka, it's looking better than ever. Yamanaka recently hired Naoto Fukasawa, Japan's unofficial creative director, to be Maruni's official creative director. Monocle's Kenji Hall paid a visit to the company's flagship in Tokyo, where Fukasawa talked him through his Hiroshima chair, which has become a symbol for the brand's new life, and Maruni's president, Yamanaka, revealed his plans for the company's future.
This chair is called Hiroshima, and it was designed by Naoto Fukasawa. Carving out that contour from the elbow to the arm was difficult, and we made prototypes over and over. It starts with the selection of the material to make sure the grain of the wood matches on the right and left. The balance has to be right, so we're careful about that. If we were to make this by hand, one chair would take, say, 2 or 3 days to complete. With the machine, it takes about an hour. The difficult thing was that it's possible to come up with a good prototype, but it's hard to do that on a factory line, on a mass production scale. It took 3 months to program the machine that would do the carving. Fukasawa-san looks for a product that requires very elaborate craft. Until now, our monozukuri was skewed towards mass production. So meeting that level of demand was very tough for the factory at first. Made by machine, that's the secret of Maruni Industries. We think it's important to find the best balance between machinery and craft, because if you rely on machine too much, design is going to be boring. But if you rely on handcraft too much, price is incredible. We don't like that. We're always trying to find the best balance.
My name is Takeshi Yamanaka, the president of Maruni Wood Industry in Hiroshima. The company was born in 1928, so we are now 83 years old.
Now, I'd like to ask about how the disaster has affected your business, and in particular, your industry.
After that, the sales declined about 3 months. But about maybe from August or September, the government pushed companies to make houses. So the economy is getting better. So the financial sales is now recovering.
Now, how has your company responded to the drop in consumer demand? Do you wait until demand recovers, or do you go out and aggressively market? If you can talk also a little bit about how in Japan, just after the disaster, there was a ban, a self-imposed ban on advertising. Companies weren't advertising in magazines or newspapers or on TV. And how did that affect your business?
Actually, we were just waiting. If we make like some cheaper products or some kind of stuff, maybe a factory will be confused. And also our customers doesn't require those products. And Fukasawa-san always said, you have to make only right design. So we always follow that way of thinking.
Can you talk a little bit about the role of design in your company's history? You know, you make chairs that have been designed, as you said, by designers like Naoto Fukasawa and Jasper Morrison. And you also produce the chairs that were designed by Sanaa. I mean, your company is very fortunate in that you have these fantastic designers to work for you and to help you with design. But that wasn't always the case. How did you decide to begin working with them?
How designers find our technique is the most important thing, I think. And how I can communicate with designers. Because many designers are asking us to make products. But for me, the most important thing is if we can share the direction of the products, we can do it. But even the design is very famous, but if I can't share the vision, I never work with them.
So, are there certain markets that you're looking at in particular to target?
We have dealers in 20 countries, but we are not strong in Asia. So our international sales manager is going Asia too. So,
are there certain countries in Asia that you're interested in?
Of course, China will be the big market.
Is there a reason you focused most of your efforts on Europe?
Because they have very long history. And if they appreciate our products in Europe, maybe our brand value gets better.
That was Monocle's Kenji Hall talking to Takeshi Yamanaka from Maruni. You're listening to Section D here on Monocle 24. Time now for a bit of a bang, as our photo director, Poppy Shibamoto, tells us about her love for fireworks.
We just had Guy Fawkes Day in London. The fireworks are mainly associated with November 5th in Britain. However, in Japan, they are more seasonal in summer. We head out to firework fairs wearing yukatas and jinbeis with geta sandals and uchiwa fans to the beach or by the riverbank, or we watch the display on the mountainside from below. Children also light little handheld sparklers in the garden before they go to bed during the summer break. The Japanese word for firework is hanabi, which means flower made of fire. It is no surprise that some of the fireworks in Japan have names like a peony or chrysanthemum. My favorite firework is the senko hanabi, a most delicate sparkler made with coiled washi paper of many colors. Once it has been lit, the burning tip of the paper forms a small fiery ball, the size of a BB gun shot. First, it starts to produce exuberant metallic flare, and then it comes down to delicate sparks that branches outwards. They are so fine that they look like they have been drawn by a freshly sharpened grade H pencil. One must hold this sparkler very steadily, because if your ball drops, your sparkler's life will come to an abrupt end. As long as you can keep your fine droplet attached, you can enjoy a complex formation of a brilliantly fiery tendrils. This all depends on your steady hand. Gunpowder originates in China, and the first firework was brought to Japan from China by an English tradesman and was believed to be presented to Shogun Ieyasu Tokunaga in the beginning of the 17th century. Since then, Hanabi has brought us a real sense of summer and has been loved through all Japan and beyond. For Monaco, I'm Poppy Shibamoto from Picture Desk.
This is Monaco 24.
Vous écoutez Monaco 24.
Dette Monaco 24.
Essa Monaco 24.
This is Monaco 24.
Then a Monaco 24 podcast, yeah.
Monaco 24 is your episode.
This is Monaco 24.
Tämä on Monaco 24. Dobro
pozdravljati. Monaco 24.
This is 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 Monaco 24.
You're listening to Monaco 24.
Welcome back to Section D here on Monaco 24. I'm Hugo MacDonald. Japanese design has an addictive quality to it, and not just for consumers. There's a school of product designers who, following an enlightened trip or period working in Japan, channel the less is more principle in all that they do. One such designer is Sam Hecht, one half of London-based studio Industrial Facility. Former head of design at IDEO, as well as running his own studio with partner Kim Collin, Hecht is now a retained designer at Muji. I dropped by to hear about his special relationship to Japanese design. Oh, hello, I'm here to see Sam. It's Hugo from Monaco.
Take the lift.
Thank you.
These pots, which we've had for a long time.
Pans.
Pans and pots, yeah. They're by a designer called Sori Yanagi.
Of course.
Who is an interesting guy. I mean, I didn't know a lot about him when I studied design, but when I started to work and also when I lived in Japan, they had this amazing exhibition of his work. It was in a department store. And that's something very, very unique about Japan, is that their department stores, in fact, the whole idea about consumption is as much a kind of a cultural endeavor as it is a need or a desire. So you can be walking through department stores and you can come across these kind of small exhibitions, and it might be about a particular craft or craftsman or designer, or without you realizing it, you are kind of being educated in some ways.
But that's so fantastic. I mean, Sori Yanagi is obviously one of the masters of Japanese design from the 20th century.
Yeah.
But he's really sunk into the minds of sort of everyday Japanese people, not just the design industry, do you think?
Certainly his work is you do see it in a lot of places, and it has kind of melted into a lot of Japan.
And is that because his things are sort of the essence of function? You don't have to be a design connoisseur to appreciate how his pans are made.
Well, because they're very right in the sense that they have this kind of this rightness to them in terms of their functional aspects, but because of that they have a certain kind of quality that you feel happy to be around. And so I picked up these pans, and they're very clever. What they do is they're very thin stainless steel, beautifully made, in the sense that they're not expensive, but they are put together very, very well. You know, you can't see the kind of the weld lines or anything, and it's a very simple idea. It's a pan that is kind of has an asymmetrical shape, and what he's done is he's kind of morphed two spouts on the pan, but they don't look like spouts. They allow you to pour, and then you have a lid which matches it. But the great thing about it is that as you're boiling something, you just have to turn the lid, and that allows the steam to come out without having to adjust it or move it.
So you precariously balance the lid on a spoon or anything?
Yeah.
So it's...
And I think this is an amazing thing about Yanagi. In fact, amazing thing about Japan in general is that they have this great ability to be able to think about function or action where there's almost like different sets of actions, but within one product.
Go in here, which is our workshop.
Nice and workshoppy.
Yeah, and I thought I'd maybe share with you a couple of things we've very recently done with Muji. And obviously, for people who don't know, Muji is a very, very popular company.
I hope everyone knows Muji.
Yeah, I mean, the funny thing about Muji is that my first experience of it was as a student when they first came to London, and they were brought over by Liberty's. And it was just a massive kind of revelation for me, because they were doing something which at that time no one was doing. You know, every product had a logo on it. Every T-shirt was bought because it had a brand on it. And here was this kind of very, very refreshing concept of removing the brand. And in doing that, you also kind of see the object for what it is. But what's also interesting is that when I went to Japan, you realize that Muji is actually something else entirely. It's a place where you go because you need something, but you're not quite sure how to fulfill it. You know, you have a little space in your bathroom, and you know that that space would be better if it was better organized, and you would go to Muji and you would kind of find the boxes and the containers and the items that would really make it very soothing and pleasing. So it's not a kind of design, and Muji is not necessarily intertwined as we think it is.
But having said that, you design for Muji.
Well, we do. But we design for Muji because we love it, not necessarily because we want our name to be associated with it, or we don't, or visible. It's more that we just love the idea of great products at reasonable prices, and they give us that opportunity. So you know, this is now our 10th year, and it's great.
And is it unusual that Muji works with designers who aren't Japanese? Because the whole sort of ethos behind Muji products is very much ingrained in Japanese design tradition. I would have thought that it was a little bit unusual for...
Well, it wasn't unusual for me in that, of course, I've been living in Japan. It was quite sad to a point where, I was like, I was buying suits from Muji, underwear, food. I was just really, really impressed. And I knew that I wanted to get to know them better and to see if I could contribute something. But when I first met them, they thought that I was a bit of a nutter in that I knew their products better than they did. I would show them catalogues of Muji products, which they didn't even have the catalogues anymore. It was like that, you could say I was a bit of a fan.
Should we talk a little bit about these?
Yeah, so this is a couple of new projects that have come about quite recently, the last couple of months. This one is a very nice little timer light for children.
What's it made out of?
It's made out of silicone.
Okay.
So it's very soft.
Oh gosh, yes.
And
it's very satisfying. I still want to try and put it in my mouth.
it has that kind of tastiness to it. So, I mean, it's the form of it is it's very difficult, but because light is light, but at the same time it does have a physical presence. And so this is just a really very similar to these Japanese lanterns that you see, and they're very nice shapes because they're not round, they're not circular, they're kind of slightly stretched. So that was the idea, but apart from the form, it was really an idea of how my experience with my kids, in that they like a light on at night, so you leave it on, and then of course it stays on all night and then all morning, unless you go up and turn it off. So this is just basically a little timer light, and you can turn it on, and then you can choose whether you want it on for 30 minutes or 60 minutes, and then during that period, the light gradually kind of fades.
Small things make a big difference.
Yeah. Maybe if we go upstairs. I just wanted to
I mean, we talked earlier about Turkey Hands. Yeah. And I mean, in our office we drink from Turkey Hands mugs.
Brilliant.
And what's amazing is, of course, it's a huge mug, which is clearly meant for naive tourists like me to buy it and then bring it back. And I've never seen one with such a big mug
in Japan. But you've been sucked in.
Yeah, but to try and put, I mean, the reason to show it is that, I mean, it's very, very hard to describe what Tokyo Hands is to someone who hasn't been there. But if I could try, it's essentially almost like a pilgrimage to consumption. It's a place where, on one level, anything in your life that has frustrated you, it will solve. If there's a particular shoelace that you can't get anywhere and it really annoys you, you will find it there. Oh yeah, I mean, I should actually explain that it is a department store. I don't quite know what shopping once was, say 50 years ago, but I could imagine that perhaps it once was like this, where there was a feeling of education, where people were demonstrating things in front of you. Those elements have kind of been lost a bit, and now they've been replaced with kind of pure materialism, which is all about desire. And Tokyo Hands is much more than that.
There's something very primeval about it, isn't there?
Yeah.
And actually, I mean, you mentioned spending days there, which sounds like an exaggeration, but I totally relate to that, because I went for an hour in my first time to Tokyo, thinking, oh, you know, everybody talks about it, I've got to go and see.
And I
ended up spending about 6 hours there. And just the sheer range, but actually more than what was on sale, it was watching how Japanese people were buying and how they were looking for things. And that was, I think I probably learned more about Japanese approach to consumerism and design
from
those 6 hours than I did for the rest of the 10 days that I spent in Japan.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it definitely, Tokyo Hands is not the kind of place where you can do a pop-in.
No.
I mean, you can go in 5 minutes and...
I know, you can maybe pop in to restock your mugs, but that's about it.
Yeah. This is called a shoku ruler, and they're little stainless steel rulers.
We have them in our office.
Yeah, we use them. We use them in our office. Everyone has one, and it's a little thing, but it's perfect. It's absolutely perfect in terms of its material. You know, it's totally indestructible, and the clarity is amazing of its font for a little ruler. And whatever people say about digital, you know, we certainly still need a ruler every day. So there was an interesting story, because I loved this font, and about 3 or 4 years ago, we were asked to design a watch for Muji. And I thought, well, it would be lovely to use the same font as this ruler. But of course, it was the ruler company's own font. And I managed to get Muji to contact them to see if we could license the font that they used in their ruler, and they agreed. So we made this very nice watch that used the same font. And of course, it looked like a ruler.
Wonderful. And did you name it after the ruler?
No, we called it a circumference watch, because it was a form of measurement.
Food Light was one of the more heartwarming events to take place during Tokyo Design Week, bringing together designers, artists, chefs and food producers from all over Japan in a bid to see how they can work together to support each other. Monocle's Kenji Hall tells us more.
Okay, picture this. Farmers rubbing elbows with foodies at a museum. As unlikely as that sounds, that's exactly what you would have seen if you had dropped by the Museum of Contemporary Art Tokyo a few nights ago. 250 people, all serious gourmets, crammed into a room for an event called Food Light. Created by designers in Tokyo and chefs from Chez Panisse, Alice Waters' pioneering restaurant in Berkeley, California, the event brought together farmers, hunters, chefs, and diners all under one roof.
But by far the stars of the event were the food producers. Hunters serving venison burgers and pigeon salad with mizuna and crispy persimmon. Farmers handing out rice balls and pork belly and satsuma and chatting away about soil and feed and harvesting. Oh, and there was wine, lots of it. The event coincided with Tokyo Design Week, and it showed how designers are helping to change the image of farming as the most unglamorous of occupations. I spoke with Naoki Ito, the creative director and chief creative officer at Party, a Tokyo-based agency that specializes in design, advertising, and branding, and one of the main organizers of the event.
This event brings together the producers, chefs, and consumers into one place. In the past, there was a call for greater traceability of food, who made it and when. What people want now is more transparency about their food. Since the disaster, radiation-contaminated food has become a problem. We are in the midst of a food crisis. The government recently tightened its regulations on radiation levels in food, and suddenly a lot of farm produce was no longer deemed safe to eat. We've seen a gradual emergence of farmers' markets in Tokyo, where you have producers selling directly to consumers. But it's still more of a transaction between a buyer and seller. Here, you can thresh the rice and eat the rice ball, prepared by the farmer in the same place, not just by a bag of rice. Food takes on a whole new meaning. Until now, if you went to the countryside in Japan, upscale ryokan, traditional inns, were the only ones that took advantage of design. Recently, there have been a few farms that used design. Because the economy has been so bad, a lot of designers have been out of work. Here, you have great farmers and designers in one place.
I wanted to know what the farmers thought of the spectacle. So I went into the kitchen and found a fifth-generation rice farmer from Shiga Prefecture, Takakazu Yagura. Yagura never wanted to be a rice farmer. In fact, he studied civil engineering in university. He had no intention of taking over the family business, but then family duty called. For Yagura, farming was too much about output and money. Grow the crop, sell the harvest. So he's done something very different from his parents. Now he shuns agrochemicals, and he shows up at events like Food Light. I asked Yagura whether he thought design could help the farming industry in some way. Just wondering, do you think that design has a role in farming and in connecting farmers with consumers?
Till about 10 years ago, farmers would grow food and the local JA Farm Cooperative would buy it. For me, it just felt like a financial transaction. We had no feedback from consumers. A farmer's market that started 2 years ago in Osaka was the first time that I met the people who were eating the rice and heard what they thought of it. I used to think that if I made something that was high quality, it would be good enough. But I now realize that you need someone to translate the ideas. Design can play that role of whittling the ideas down, making them easier to understand, more familiar. Other farmers nearby and I have formed a team to participate in farmers' markets and other events like this. We're not just trying to do things on our own. It's not about making money. It's about meeting people and thinking about the possibilities of farming. We get to directly hear and sense what consumers and the chefs are saying about the produce we grow. There are some farmers who've frown on our participating in these events. But it's a fact that there are people who are becoming more accepting of this kind of thing. The concept of this event brings chefs, producers, artists together. Each has a role. On the first night, I worked alongside the chefs in the kitchen. I had always thought they just selected produce. But in working with them, I learned that they have a lot of respect for us farmers. It was a great chance to see a side of food preparation I had never known. I hope this event continues and that I can participate in it again.
That was Monocle's Kenji Hall in Tokyo at the Food Light exhibition.
Every Monday, Monocle's culture editor, Robert Bound, casts a keen eye across the week's cultural events, taking in cinema, art, music, media, literature, and some of the world's more exclusive events. That's Culture with Robert Bound, premiering every Monday on Monocle 24 at 1900 London time and available on our Timeshift player and on iTunes.
For listeners in Tokyo or visitors to Japan, you can now enjoy a coffee, a Wilkinson dry ginger ale, or our classic curry at our first ever Monocle cafe and shop at the new Hankyu Men's Department Store, just steps from Ginza and the lobby of the peninsula. Featuring a Monocle shop, stocked with our ever-expanding collection of special collaborations, the Monocle cafe is the perfect place to refuel after a run round the Imperial Palace or a busy day in Marunouchi. For more details, visit monocle.com.
Welcome back to Section D here on Monocle 24. There's just time for a trolley dash around the world. And this week, in keeping with our Japanese theme, we headed to three stores who specialise in Japanese design to hear what's ringing their tills. First up, we visited Jay Patel, director of the Japanese Knife Company. No prizes for guessing what they sell. Around the corner from Midori House in London's Marylebone.
We've tried to incorporate the idea of the display with food. So what we've used is different coloured lentils, which we've put down, and then we put down the blades on top of that. Really, the blades do the talking, because the background is there just to support the colours, but it's the knives themselves. If you look at the knives, they are absolutely gorgeous to look at. Whilst they are absolutely totally functional tools, they are also aesthetically really beautiful to look at, because at the end of the day, you've got to use a knife in your hand for the next 25 or 30 years, or maybe even 50 years. You don't want something that's ugly. Here we have a blade called a Sakimura Tako. It's a sword-tipped blade designed for cutting any kind of boneless flesh, either meat or fish. It's been made by another living treasure of Japan called Hirano. It's been folded, six-fold steel. It is pricey at about £2,000, but once you use that blade, there's no other knife that you're ever going to use in the rest of it. Anytime you use a kitchen knife, you'll always remember this.
Hi, my name's Matt Jensen. I'm the owner of MJ Bale, based in Sydney. What's really selling? We're coming into springtime down here. In fact, we're just about to roll over into summer. So what's selling are our cotton, linen blends of deconstructed jackets and suiting the lean chinos that are running with them. Got a couple little things in our shop window at the moment. One is a curated edit of our lookbook, which is ceiling mounted on a nice old-fashioned canvas. And sitting next to that is a seersucker jacket, blue and white. We sourced the cloth out of Japan, and we constructed in Japan as well. The interesting thing about the male consumer here in Sydney is that they love their classics. So they're loving their classic navy suit, beautiful white shirt, keeping it very simple, wearing it back with accessories, little pocket chiefs or ties. Knit ties are going very well, and I think that will continue to roll into all seasons. So we created the MJ Bale brand 2 years ago. I was the founder of it. And our goal is to realise the vision of the beautiful raw materials we have here in Australia. I've been working with various Japanese companies now for about 8 years, and really it's to do with the philosophy of work or of business over there in Japan, where they have great integrity, creativity, attention to detail, and terrific service.
My name is Sumiko Watanabe, and I work at Tortoise General Store. I'm the store manager here. All the things at the store is either designed or manufactured in Japan from all over the country. So, you know, we're a small store, but it's like traveling to Japan. When you look through the window, you'll see the paper lanterns hanging, the woodblock print animals, the rain boots, which are originally rice planting boots, some glass vases, and these stone vases. that looks like stones, but it has a hole in it and it's a vase. We try to show the variety of the things that we carry. We are a tortoise general store, so we do carry general home things, both decorative and functional. Especially because the holidays coming, we've been selling a lot of the Mari balls, which is a hand-coiled vegetable-dyed balls. There's a little string on it, so you can hang it on a Christmas tree. But in Japan, this is not a seasonal item. We hang it all year round. And these are made by craftsmen. They're about 70 or 80 years old women. And they make it all in their hand. So depending on the size of their hand, the size varies. It used to be a hobby. The grandmas would make it for their granddaughter or grandson. And they actually recently got a young woman who is 60 years old. And they're very excited that the younger generation is starting to make interested in this production. So this baby kimono, it's called ubugi. And this is a little kimono, baby's first kimono, which is good for newborn to 2 years old. And these are made by two pieces of tenugui, which is a multi-purpose cloth that we sell. When the baby is newborn, you use it as a wrapper. And when the baby is about 1 year old, there's a little stitch on the shoulder. And you can cut the hand stitch, and it'll expand and become a shirt. So the baby can wear with the leggings. And in the old days, the moms, when the babies are still in their tummy, they would hand make this for their baby. And instead of buying new clothes every 3 months, it's a concept of, you know, appreciating one item for a very long time. And after they grow up, they can keep it as a good memory. A lot of things are very simple design. It doesn't have any like funky, colory designs or anything. But each product, if you pick them up on your hand, you can tell it has a little story behind it. Like the tea canister craftsman, he's a fifth generation craftsman. And Kaikado is the first and the only tea canister maker in Japan that still makes everything handmade. The material is three different kinds, tin, brass, and copper. And there's an inner lid and also an outer lid with lines on it. And see, you just put the lid on and let your hand off the lid. It goes down by itself. And as it does that, it seals out all the air. And this is a proof that is all handmade. This will not happen if it's a machine made.
You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24. And that's all we've got time for this week, I'm afraid. But fear not. Next week, we're back with a Terence Conran special, speaking to the great man himself and his vast band of devotees to hear how he transformed the design landscape at home in the UK and abroad. In the meantime, thank you for listening. Arigato gozaimasu. Soshite, sayonara.